During the confrontation, it is alleged the 13-year-old boy made a threat against the officer that led the officer to believe that he was going to shoot him. At that point, the juvenile walked away, and the officer made the decision to try and detain the juvenile pending our arrival. While physically detaining the juvenile, several houses away from where the initial incident began, several other juveniles became involved and a physical altercation ensued. At least two juveniles physically assaulted the officer, knocking him to the ground. Following the second battery, and as several people began to surround the officer removed a handgun removed a handgun and one round was discharged.
That's Anaheim Police Chief Raul Quezada speaking at a news conference yesterday. He's talking about an incident that happened earlier this week on Tuesday. An off-duty LAPD officer who lives in Anaheim was reportedly sick of teenagers walking across his property on their way home from school, and he confronted them. And things escalated from there. Videos of the incident have gone viral. On Wednesday night, around 300 protesters marched through the city. Some confronted police. They threw rocks, smashed windows, vandalized homes. Norberto Santana is the publisher of The Voice of OC, and he joins me now to talk about what happened. Welcome to you.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And also here, Kate Mather. She covers crime and the police for the LA Times. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Norberto, this video or several videos show this off-duty officer dragging a boy who is apparently 13 years old by the collar. Other teens are around. Some of them try to intervene. It goes on for several minutes. Tell us about what happened on the videos.
Well, obviously, a deeply troubling series of events. You see the officer in an argument with some kids from around the school. You can tell that there's some history there. There's obviously been some issues with the officer not liking people crossing his lawn. And then inexplicably, as you see the incident continue to heat up, the officer drags the young boy over a hedge of bushes. Another young boy goes and heads him off. You can see the kids are pleading with the officer to let the kid go. Officers from Anaheim are on the way. As that goes over, you see on the video that the gentleman pulls a gun out of his waist. It then discharges a shot. Kids scramble out in the area. The most troubling aspects, I think, in the community, from what I've heard, is that when the Anaheim police show up, it's the two children, a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old, that are immediately arrested, and the officer is basically released on his own recognizance at that point. I think there's a lot of concerns at that point of why that was handled the way it was, why it wasn't investigated a little deeper.
Right. So it is under investigation now. Kate, can you tell us more about that?
Sure. There's two simultaneous investigations going on here, one that is being led by the Anaheim Police Department, and a second internal investigation by the LAPD, which is standard protocol. Every time an LAPD officer fires his or her gun, the department conducts an investigation. It usually takes several months to complete, where they decide whether that officer violated, or they look into whether that officer, what their tactics were leading up to the incident, why they drew their gun, why they decided to open fire. That investigation is ultimately reviewed by the Los Angeles Police Commission, which will determine whether or not the officer broke any LAPD rules during the encounter. So in addition to Anaheim Police, which are looking into whether any crimes were committed, there is the separate internal inquiry being conducted by the LAPD as well.
And will they work together, or are these two totally separate investigations?
Typically, they keep them very separate, and that has to do with statements conducted by police and whether they can be compelled to answer questions and whether because of very complicated rules protecting police officers, whether those statements could be used them in a criminal prosecution. So those investigations should be conducted parallel to each other.
Okay, Norberto, let's talk more about what has happened since these videos went viral. As I mentioned, there was this big protest that happened the next night. Tell us about what happened there and how it got violent.
Well, you know, this is, remember we had riots in 2012 in Anaheim. There's been a lot of concern about rising inequity in that city, many Latino neighborhoods that are shut out. The main attention they get from government is gang injunctions. There's been a big debate about whether there should have been much more investment in youth programs since 2012. The anger on the street, I think, clearly identifies that you still have a serious problem in Anaheim around police relations, especially in those neighborhoods where many people feel extremely disconnected.
And Kate, in a piece in your newspaper today, there was some talk about how there was a skate park that was put in near the near this neighborhood and how that might be contributing to crime, or some residents believe that that's contributing to crime, that there is this tension between young people and older residents in this neighborhood.
Yeah, my colleagues who were in the Anaheim neighborhood yesterday, when they were speaking to residents, one of the things that a handful of residents noted was that ever since this skate park was built, I think they guessed around a year and a half ago, they had noticed more quality of life crimes in their neighborhood, more graffiti, maybe some cars getting keyed, beer bottles left in the property. We want to make sure that we're not accusing the teenagers who were involved in Tuesday's incident of any of those concerns by the residents. But it's just something that observations residents have made in the last couple of months, that they have seen these kind of quality of life issues in their neighborhood, which they hadn't seen necessarily before the skate park came in.
And Norberto, if you could give us a little background and history about the relations between the Anaheim Police Department and the city residents.
Well, it's tense. This is a police department that years in the 90s was surveilling dissident Latinos who were running for city council. During the last couple of years, there's been a lot of tension, again, going all the way back to 2012, where there were officer-involved shootings of some Latino men. And again, it got very, very tense. A lot of this is going back. That's where we had this public safety board created kind of after that. However, there's some real concerns that doesn't really have any way for members of the community that have very different views about the police and about community development to be able to air their concerns. That's a debate now that's going to renew on Tuesday, where there's a big question now whether Anaheim really needs to have some sort of civilian review, because in an instant like this, without that video, it would have been a very different tale. And you get back to what can you really talk about when these investigations go on? They will go on for a long time. At the same time, the mayor and the city council have to be able to go back to their community and say that at least something's happened or some sort of review is ensued. So I think a lot of pressure now is going to go back onto the police and the community relations. And how do you set up something like a civilian review board or something similarly, taking into account all the different issues like the Police Officer Bill of Rights? And how do you get those two communities to talk to each other? In Anaheim, that's the big worry, that 5 years have passed and there's really been no progress on that front.
Norberto Santana, publisher of The Voice of OC, Kate Mather, covering crime and the police for the LA Times. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
California Republicans meet in Sacramento this weekend for their biannual convention. Much of the talk will center on how to rebuild the party here. Only about a quarter of California voters are Republicans. Democrats hold both the governorship and a supermajority in the legislature. So what can California Republicans do? Joining us now is Republican strategist Luis Alvarado. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure being here with you.
Great to have you. Well, the party's been in trouble for a while now, but it seems like it's really in trouble now, given the last election. So where do you begin to rebuild the party?
Well, I think its first strategy is do no more harm. And that is make sure the things that are successful, like helping municipal Republicans that are the greater majority of people who hold offices like mayorships, city council, school districts, make sure they continue to do a good job for their districts. And after that, start finding a way to elevate those success stories so the community can have an opportunity to have them, represent with Republican values at Sacramento level mm-hmm. and at Washington level.
Well, there's been, as we've seen in the news this week during the recess, a lot of anger at town hall meetings, chiefly held by Republicans. And are you sensing that that anger is also bleeding into local, office holders who are Republican? And how do California Republicans try to distance themselves from this anger against congressional Republicans and against President Donald Trump?
And that's one of the challenges we started seeing already in November, when we saw many Republicans who were even running for nonpartisan office being specifically targeted and attacked by Democrats as being pro-Trump and trying to hold that huge news over their heads as if we do not vote for a Democrat, you're going to have a Trump-like person representing your school district. Now that President Trump is in the White House, that's even going to be a more heavier opportunity for Democrats to attack Republicans. And Republicans have to be conscious of that and be prepared to demonstrate how they personally do not stand for those things that Donald Trump may not be a good character for.
So what are those things exactly? What are those things exactly that you would want to distance yourself as a Republican? You're a consultant. What would you advise Republicans to say, you know what, this part of the Trump agenda is not my part? What parts specifically?
Well, I recommend to my clients that they have to be courageous. And when they find this agreement with this administration, that they're eloquent in building an argument that does not shy them away or does not also open an attack from fellow Republicans, but also demonstrate that there are things that we need to do, or they have to do, to ensure that they do a good job for the specific job that they're seeking. So if you're running for a school board or you're running for a college board, the administration may have some policies that may not fit with that specific district's needs, and one candidate needs to be able to be eloquent in saying how they would separate those aspects of the political agenda or their platforms and how they would represent the district and things that actually would move the district forward.
What about immigration? You have, of course, the executive order to pull funding from sanctuary cities. You have the ban on travelers from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Now you've got these memos from DHS and the crackdown on undocumented immigrants. What does the California Republican Party have to do about that, and what should its position be?
Well, I think that's one of the greatest questions, because many of the Republicans who voted for Donald Trump voted understanding that they knew that he was a kind of, quote, loose cannon with his words, and that many of the things that he was saying was just rhetoric, that he would never follow through. If he does have a follow-through strategy that would actually affect the immigrant community, specifically in states like California, that the economy is heavily dependent on this immigrant community, then many Republicans are going to find themselves in opposition to Donald Trump's administration, just like we're starting to see in town halls with regards to Obamacare. Those that voted for Donald Trump did not want Hillary Clinton, but now they have to face the fact that they themselves are going to be affected if Donald Trump follows through with many of those promises that he made during the campaign trail.
Well, you're sounding like a Democrat right now.
I've been accused of that by Democrats and Republicans, but I like to think that I am truly a Republican. My values of conservatism are still strong. I do believe in open and free media. That doesn't make me a Democrat. But the reality is we want to make sure that we have viable opportunities for economic success. We have a strong defense. And sometimes Donald Trump's administration doesn't seem to be in coordination with those Republican values that we have had for many years at many conventions that I have been present as a delegate.
Did you support Donald Trump?
I did not. I have not supported Donald Trump. But as is my president and as the leader of my country, I do give him 100% support. But when I do find opposition with him, I'm going to be courageous and talk about it. But in the interest of the things that I believe in of my party, I will always support any Republican that actually wants to do a good job to represent their district. And we can always be happy to disagree. And this is not just happening in the Republican Party. We also see it in the Democratic Party between the extreme progressives and the establishment Democrats. So it's not just a Republican challenge, it's a Democrat challenge as well.
But how do you advise representatives in red districts, you know, maybe in the central part, eastern part of the state here in California, where the voters do like Donald Trump and they did vote for him by large majorities? And so how do you advise them in terms of negotiating where they stand?
Well, because it is a challenge to enter in a discussion where you're most likely not going to win, I advise them to concentrate on the issues that you are going to find agreement, the things that people in your district do care about. In the Central Valley, water will always be a focal point of ensuring that conservative values are actually helping the local economy. And that's what I recommend them to do, to talk about the issues of the district. Let Washington do what they have to do. When a candidate has an opportunity to stand up for the district and stand up to Washington if that's needed, then they're going to have to find a way of doing it and be eloquent about it.
And do you see the future of the Republican Party as strong? And if so, when do you see it regaining power in California?
Well, like I mentioned, there are good things that are happening, specifically at the municipal level. And I truly believe that our leader, Jim Brulte, is already engaging, ensuring that there is a pathway to elevate those leaders in the local communities who already have gained the respect of Democrats for their fiscal conservative values, who have earned the respect of the Latino community and big Latino districts for being true to their oath, and then giving them an opportunity to present an argument how they also can be effective in Sacramento in other offices, either at the Senate, Assembly, or state level.
So do you think they'll regain power anytime soon?
I think the challenge is steep. I think that the strategy is sound. It's now a matter of implementation, and I think that's what this convention in Sacramento is about, is how do we get now from point A to point B. We do have great Republicans that are doing fabulous jobs. We have the mayor of San Diego, who is San Diego mostly a Democrat community, and we have a Republican that is well-liked and now has won re-election. And I think that presents a model for the type of Republican that actually can be successful in California, who would probably not be successful in a state like Texas mm-hmm. or Atlanta or Virginia.
All right. Luis Alvarado, Republican strategist based here in Los Angeles. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for talking to me.
All right. We want to hear from you. What do you think Republicans should do to win over more voters here in California? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why are there so few black architects? And a tour this weekend in Compton highlights the history of African-American architects here in Los Angeles. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When people think of iconic Los Angeles architects, they think of names like Frank Gehry, John Lautner, Richard Neutra, all highly skilled and talented, to be sure, but also all male and all white. African-Americans have been underrepresented in L.A. architecture, even though they make up 10% of L.A. County's population. Fewer than 2% of practicing architects are black. Well, this weekend, the Los Angeles chapter of the American Institute of Architects is hosting a walking tour of 6 buildings in Compton. The tour highlights significant works by black architects and designers and explores why architecture is so white. I'm joined by the co-hosts of that tour now. Drake Dillard is an architect who designed the Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science in Compton, as well as other projects. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Jason Morris, also an architect here in L.A. He has researched local projects by African-American designers and architects and put out a map where you can find them. Hi there.
Hey. Hello.
Well, thank you both for coming in today. Jason, let's begin with you. Why have black architects been so underrepresented, do you think?
I think a lot of it is just a matter of access. You know, historically, you know, African-Americans haven't really had access to the same education and opportunities. I mean, there are a lot of people that have wanted to become architects that really found trouble breaking into the profession just due to the fact that it was majority, you know, white and male. The firms were white and male, and the clients were white and male.
Yeah. And Drake, was that your experience?
Yes. It's a story that I think needs to be told over and over again. And I think this show is good to have it because I think it started the conversation mm-hmm. so people could understand, as an African-American architect, what are some of the issues you deal with and some of the things you have to go through to become a licensed architect in this country. A lot of progress has been made, but of course, it's a lot more that still needs to be made in the future.
And what year did you become a licensed architect?
Oh my goodness, what year? 1979.
Oh my gosh.
Hey, so, It's been a while.
Okay, right. So cast your mind back to then. What was it like trying to break into the profession, get commissions?
Yeah, very good word, commission, because that's very
Thank
important.
You.
We'll come back to that later, hopefully. Commissions is very, that's getting projects, getting work. But for me, as a student, originally from Chicago, attending University of Illinois, my graduate master is from Howard University. So it was very difficult back in those days. Mm-hmm. I mean, going to a historically black university, Howard, you had a lot of support, and that helped me out tremendously.
Mm. So when you came to Los Angeles to be an architect,
correct.
What was it like trying to break in?
I was hired by a firm in Malibu, California, relocated from the Midwest, to work in a firm called Medical Plan Associates. And at that time, I was a young, growing, maturing architect. So it wasn't my firm, and I was not responsible for actually getting work. But mm-hmm. I do know that in terms of most African Americans who have their own office, that is one of the main issues, and that is basically getting work, getting
yeah.
commissions. And that makes or break you, obviously. I think with this new wave of building, I've seen a new interest in diversity and at a whole different level
mm.
in my whole career. I've never seen it before in my whole career, and it's very positive. But the commission of work is very, very, very important. Because there's firms like Raw International is a historically black African-American firm, been around a long time, and they're still, beating the bushes to get work. And very, very successful, but it's been a hard road to climb. And now you're competing against the larger firms, because now the larger firms are doing projects that Raw is interested in doing. So,
but everyone's competing against
exactly.
the Genslers of the world, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, so let's talk about the tour this weekend and why you thought it was necessary to have this tour and what people will see in Compton, Jason.
Well, I mean, I have to start by saying that, the impetus for the tour was really the map, and the projects were actually taken from the map.
And, this is the map you created.
Right.
Of...
It's a map of projects that were designed or significantly contributed to by African-American architects.
And the reason for the map.
Right. And, Deborah Gerard, partner over at Green Associates, where I work, she went down to Philadelphia for the AIA National Conference last year. And they were handing out maps of buildings from the downtown area. And she said, hey, why can't we do this here? And so she approaches me and she says, hey, Jason, why can't we do this here and feature black architects and their work? And so she enlisted me to kind of lead the efforts of the project. And we did tons of research and, looking for the buildings and everything. And so that map was actually given out to all of the attendees at the NOMA, National Organization for Minority Architects, conference in October. And so AALA actually saw that and decided to take that and create a tour behind it. And so we selected these projects in Compton that we felt like represented some of the underrepresented architects, of the profession.
So you chose six buildings mm-hmm. in Compton.
This map had a total of maybe 50 or so?
Yeah, just about.
That was going to be my next question.
Okay.
How many buildings are there on your map?
Right, it's about 50 buildings.
And that's not all. There should be more.
All. Yeah.
We just didn't have time to do all
right.
whatever number it is.
The focus was on buildings that had seemed to have some sort of cultural or civic mm-hmm. impact. In Los Angeles. So, of course, it's not an exhaustive list,
right.
but, it's a selection.
So I think maybe the most famous African-American architect is Paul Revere Williams, mm-hmm. who did the LAX encounter.
And many,
theme building
many
and
other,
many others. The yeah. AME Church,
mm-hmm.
the courthouse downtown,
mm-hmm. Saks Fifth Avenue,
right? Exactly. Yep. So he's not his buildings aren't on your tour because they're not in Compton.
That's correct.
Right.
That is correct.
Your building, the Charles Drew University, is going to be there.
It's going to be one of the buildings.
One of the correct. Buildings,
right.
And that's a big coup. That.
Yeah, yeah, it's a interesting story real quick about that building. I got a phone call actually about a week ago from staff from the building. They saw advertisement about their building being on a tour, and it was amazing. They invited me to talk to them about that, which I did, and there was just so much. It was amazing. It was so much pride and shown that. Their building is part of this tour.
And Jason, what else is on the tour that you want to talk about?
Well, we have the Compton City Hall, mm-hmm. you know, done by Harold L. Williams.
No relation to Paul Williams.
No relation to Paul Williams. There's a lot of Williams, Gregory Williams.
That's true.
lots of Williams for black architects.
Actually, Harold just passed away not too long ago. So, but he has a fantastic history. And we're not going to tell you because we're going to leave that for people to come to the tour to find out more.
Can you give us a little teaser?
Well, Compton City Hall is the tallest building designed by an African American west of the Mississippi.
Hmm. And what is the style of it?
When you come to the tour, you can see the style of the building.
That's also a surprise. That's what you're saying?
It's a tease.
Okay, so it sounds like things are changing and changing pretty rapidly mm-hmm. for minority architects. What do you think the profession, though, could do better?
I think that the profession could do better at recognizing black architects. And, you know, that's kind of where I see that we've made progress with the map that we created, is that I think that a lot of black architects aren't visible. They're not always considered all the time for the awards because, you know, architecture is very much an awards community, you know, lots of awards every year. And so I hope that we can get more people that are recognized in that way. Paul Williams, he just got the gold medal, you know, and I think that that's a step mm-hmm. progress in the right direction.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you.
That's Drake Dillard. He's an architect. He designed the Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science in Compton and other projects. Jason Morris, also an architect in Los Angeles. Together, they are guiding a walking tour of architecture in Compton. It's this Sunday from 10 a.m. to noon, hosted by the LA chapter of the American Institute of Architects. And you can find a link to all the info on our Facebook page, KTRW Press Play. Coming up, new movies out this weekend, including an animated French film up for an Academy Award.
This is beautiful and really strange, and it's not going to win the Oscar this weekend, I don't think, but just the fact that it's nominated is really great and will maybe get some eyeballs on it that wouldn't ordinarily see it.
Ma Vie de Courgette, as well as Jordan Peele's new movie, Get Out. Movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Academy Awards are, of course, this Sunday, so you have a little bit of time left to check out some of the nominated films you've been meaning to catch before the big show, including possibly a beautifully crafted long shot for Best Animated Feature Award you may never have heard of. We're going to talk about that and the other new releases coming out this weekend, non-Oscar bait movies, perhaps, with Christy Lemire, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Hi there.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you. Okay, well, let's, before we get to that film, it's an animated film, we're going to talk about Get Out. This is the directorial debut of Jordan Peele, of Key and Peele. He's a funny guy. This is a not-so-funny movie, perhaps. It's kind of a horror film. Here's a clip.
Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see no brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here. Get out.
Sorry, man. Okay.
Get out!
Yo! Rose, we gotta go.
Is everything okay?
Rose, the keys.
Wow. Okay. So everything's not okay. What is the premise of this movie?
This is the most amazing, daring, sharp, beautifully written, acted film. All the hype is totally justified.
Really?
It's this amazing combination of stuff because it is this very biting, witty satire about race and about how we regard each other and how people don't want to admit that they have any kind of even slight racist underpinnings to the way they regard others or the things they say. It is a funny, biting satire that very slowly, very assuredly morphs into a horror film. It is essentially Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but it becomes a horror film. And it reminds me of those Edgar Wright movies like Shaun of the Dead or like Hot Fuzz, where they begin life as one genre and then become another very skillfully. And Jordan Peele wrote and directed it. It's his first film. I'm amazed this got made within the studio system because it is so daring and it really, it nails its ambitions beautifully.
So it's called Get Out.
Yes.
And so that makes the point, right? It's about, well, a white community and they don't want black people in it?
So Daniel Kaluuya is the black actor in this. And
he's
plays a photographer, right? He's dating Allison Williams, who is white. And she brings him home to meet her family at this beautiful, awesome, gorgeous house on the lake. And Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener are her parents. And she insists, they're totally liberal. Like, my dad would have voted for Obama for a third time if he could have. He's going to love you. It's going to be fine. And then he gets there and sinister things are happening. And I don't want to give it away.
No, don't.
But it's not at all what it looks like. And it slowly but surely becomes very tense and very thrilling and very surprising. But even just the mystery of what's happening there is engrossing and scary and weird and all that. But it's what Peele is getting at underneath all of this that really, really matters in a giant mainstream film like this. And go see it. Like, it's so, all the hype is justified.
Okay. And is it at all funny?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Very, very funny.
Jordan Peele, very funny.
Very bitingly funny. He's not in it, but he wrote it, and it's great.
Okay. Next up, also kind of a thriller, I think, or maybe a love story. It's a grunge era film with a title inspired by a Nirvana song. It's called As You Are.
I've never kissed anyone.
Shut up.
I'm going to teach you to kiss.
Trying to understand here is the relationship between your son and Jack.
Don't know what there is to tell.
Okay, it's kind of hard to tell what's going on. Is this a love story between two guys?
Maybe. But it's the amorphous nature of it is part of what is so cool about this film. And it's from this very young, very exciting filmmaker, Miles Joris Perafeet. I might be just destroying his name, but that's what it is. He was only 23 when he made this. This played at Sundance a year ago. And he has this great eye for artful imagery and a great ear for dialogue, like wise beyond his years in his filmmaking capacity. It's these three friends in the early 90s, two guys and a girl. And it goes back and forth between the events that bring them together and then the police investigation into what happened that tore them apart. And so it goes back and forth in time and in perspective. And it really captures that sensation that when you're a teenager and you have a new best friend, that it has the giddy thrill of falling in love. Mm-hmm. You know, that someone really, truly gets you in an intimate way, even though maybe you're still figuring out who you are
and
yourself.
And often you see that with two girls.
Yes.
You don't see it with two boys that often.
And this is very honest in the way that that kind of dynamic can exist between two young men as well.
Uh-huh.
And then this girl comes into the equation too, and that's sort of changes everything. It's really sharp. It's really dreamlike in the way that it looks. It kind of explores some visual and thematic territory of some Gus Van Sant movies. Mm. Like, yeah, that, but just like some of the dreamlike high school movies that he has made. And it's just, it's really surprising and really good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'd recommend that one?
I would. So given that it's February, it's
right.
Oscar weekend. There's some surprisingly good stuff out there. Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to something that might not fit that bill. Rock Dog. This is an animated movie about a Tibetan mastiff who wants to be a rock star.
So any advice for up-and-coming musicians?
Play your guts out and never stop. Even when your dad says stop, don't stop.
You're not going to be a musician, Bodie. You're going to be a guard.
Say, isn't he old enough to take the post?
Yeah, he just doesn't take it seriously.
Okay, what's Tibetan culture plus American rock stars in British accents?
There's so much happening here. So Luke Wilson provides the voice of this dog named Bodhi, who is forced to follow in his father's footsteps, protecting this mountain, Snow Mountain, and protecting the sheep on it from the predatory wolves that want to come in and wreak havoc. J.K. Simmons is the voice of his dad. But Bodhi has these dreams of being a rock star. And he leaves the mountain and goes to the big city to find this rock star cat named Angus Scattergood, voiced here by Eddie Izzard, as we heard in the clip. Best part of the whole movie. He's like this egotistical, reclusive rock star. And he goes and finds him and learns how to be a musician with him. And it's a pretty simple concept. It's about following your dreams, being true to yourself and following your dreams, which is not a terrible idea for kids to hear. It's kind of trite, but it's not horrible. This movie's got a pretty good soundtrack between Radiohead and the Foo Fighters and Beck. There's some good songs on it. Again, Eddie Izzard is a highlight. But
as a cat, let's note.
As a cat.
Not a dog.
No, he's a cat, and they learn to get along. There's some cool visual stuff, some clever inspired stuff at the rock star's mansion, but it's harmless. If your kids want to see it, if there's nothing else for your kids to see, this is fine.
And this is a Chinese-American co-production?
I guess.
Okay.
There's just, you know, there's Chinese money
Great
in a
Wall
lot of productions.
Was a similar thing.
Yes. That's a whole other conversation to have.
And that didn't do well, right?
Speaking of being mixed
Great
up
Wall?
Culturally. You know, it's just silly. It's just silly, rampaging dinosaur dogs. This is why the Great Wall of China was built, was to fend off the dinosaur dogs. It's history. Learn about it.
Dinosaur dogs. I hadn't read that in my world history. But
rampaging.
Okay, rampaging. All right, let's talk about My Life as a Zucchini, Ma Vie de Courgette. And this is actually nominated for an Oscar, an Academy Award in the Animated Feature Film category. Tell us about this movie.
So this is beautiful and really strange. And it's not going to win the Oscar this weekend, I don't think. But just the fact that it's nominated is really great and will maybe get some eyeballs on it that wouldn't ordinarily see it. So I saw it in French with subtitles. It's coming out this weekend in theaters, dubbed in English with a cast that includes Nick Offerman and Will Forte and Amy Sedaris, and Ellen Page. So it is about this little boy who goes by the nickname Zucchini, and he is 9 years old. And at the start of the film, his mom dies, and he blames himself for it. And a police officer takes him to this foster home where he meets other kids whose parents have died or whose parents are incapable of taking care of them because they're in prison or they're drug addicts. And it's pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah.
The look of it is really beautifully detailed.
It's claymation,
it's stop
right?
motion animation, right. And so you have this really cool variety of textures between wood and clay, and some of it looks very lifelike with leaves. But it's not really for little kids. It's daring and it's ultimately hopeful, but it's pretty dark there for a long time. Very worthwhile for older kids, I would say, like 9, 10. Ultimately, there is the possibility of redemption and finding your own family.
And it's rated PG-13.
It's PG-13. Yeah, there's a lot of sexual humor in it, you know, because it's kids who are about 10 years old who are just learning about body parts and, you know, how things work, and they're hilariously wrong a lot of the time. But it is some grown-up stuff thematically and also language-wise for little kids.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it is about like resiliency and kids looking out for each other and the possibility of finding a family where you might not expect it.
And can you see it in the original French?
I guess so. Maybe streaming somewhere. I saw it on a physical screener, being in the LA Film Critics Association. Uh-huh. I saw an actual physical copy of it with subtitles. And maybe that's available in some theaters. But I do know that there's a dubbed English version coming out, which I cannot speak for. But that's a very good cast.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of the Oscars, they are this Sunday. And is there a movie that I know you like La La Land.
I like La La Land.
Yeah, is that what you want to win? Because it probably will win, right?
It will and it should. I really love Moonlight. There's sort of this little groundswell of, ooh, maybe Moonlight will win. But no, it's going to be La La Land. It's going to be Damien Chazelle for director. It's going to be pretty predictable. You know, mm-hmm. In your acting categories, I would say Denzel Washington wins Best Actor for Fences and Emma Stone wins Actress for La La Land. Mahershala Ali will win Supporting Actor for Moonlight and Viola Davis will win Supporting Actress for Fences. Those all make sense. Those are all great. There is some cool stuff that I would like to see happen possibly, like if Isabelle Huppert won Best Actress for Elle.
I would love that.
That would be amazing because it's just this daring, exquisite performance. But Emma Stone is just adorable.
What about Natalie Portman and Jackie?
I don't think there's a lot of hope for that. Yeah, no. She's very good in that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen. And then there's strange stuff I would love to see happen, like if The Lobster won Best Original Screenplay.
Just that it was nominated.
So cool.
That's good enough.
Yeah, it'll be something safe, like Manchester by the Sea will win that, you know. And the documentary category could have some surprises. It could go in a variety of ways. OJ Made in America is an incredible achievement and I think will win and should win. But, you know, I'm Not Your Negro is excellent and very powerful. 13th, excellent, very powerful. So it could go a lot of ways in that category. But, you know, it's all about the dresses. It's all about who's going to wear what.
And what they're going to say, because
that's
apparently
true.
It's going to be pretty political.
I can imagine that, and that will make things fun.
Okay, well, happy viewing.
Thank you. You as well.
Thank you. Christy Lemire is co-host of What the Flick. Check it out on YouTube. Coming up on this program, continuing our Oscars conversation, we'll get a rundown on the best foreign language films with our own Matt.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, as you just heard, the Academy Awards are this Sunday, but the Iranian director of The Salesman will not be there, even though his film is nominated for a foreign language Oscar. Asghar Farhadi's statement against the president's travel ban has put the spotlight on the foreign film category this year. A record 89 countries submitted films to the Oscars this time around. They've been whittled down to 5 final nominees, and Matt Holzman is here. He has seen all 5. He's host of KCRW's screening series First Take. He's here to tell us all about them. Hi.
Hi.
Why are you so into this category?
Well, you just have to keep in mind that the Oscars were created to celebrate Hollywood and studio movies. Mm-hmm. And although they certainly highlight so many great films, there are also films that are there largely because of their popularity. And the foreign film category, or I should say the foreign language film category, is almost always great. All 5 movies, even if you disagree, you don't like the film, there's always something interesting to talk about. There's always something interesting to see. And that's certainly true of the 5 movies this year.
And is this year different from previous years in terms of the films that were nominated?
I mean, no. There is a lot of movies, as you said in the intro. Yemen has its first entry, which I bring up just because the title is so great. It's I Am Najum, age 10, and divorced. But there was kind of actually a certain lack of drama this year. One of the things that happens, big Hollywood movies tend to be political about which films get in and which don't. In the foreign language category, the drama, the political drama, is a little more localized to the countries where the films come from. And there'll be an argument between, for instance, the established filmmakers and a filmmaker who works outside of the system as to which film will be nominated. And sometimes not the best film doesn't get nominated because it's not part of the film establishment. I didn't really hear too much of that this year. It just seemed like there were a lot of fantastic films.
Okay, let's talk about them. There's The Salesman, as I mentioned, from Iran. Tell us about that one.
Oscar Farhadi won the Oscar for foreign language film in 2012 with A Separation. And this feels in some ways like a continuation of that. It's about a husband and wife. In this case, she's attacked in their home, and it's how it changes the dynamic between these two people. And again, you have these extraordinary kind of observation of human foibles and how people interact with one another. But it also, for me, is so great to see these films because we hear so much about Iran, mm-hmm. and here's a chance to see what life is like, which is very much
that's
like
life. That's what I loved about A Separation.
Yeah, it's like life here, with a little patina of maybe some different cultural values. But this is a really riveting film in which not that much happens.
Okay. Tana from Australia.
Remarkable backstory and a remarkable film. Two Australian filmmakers go to the island of Tana, which is in Vanuatu in the South Pacific, and they use villagers there to reenact something that really happened to them, which is basically a Romeo and Juliet story where two young lovers wanted to marry, even though in their culture it's all arranged marriage, and how what happened to them changed this culture. And first of all, it is the most beautiful film you have ever seen, and it is very idyllic and very Eden-like. But the performances are wonderfully naturalistic, as you can imagine, because no one's an actor. And the story is really, it's beautiful. It's one of the most romantic movies you'll ever see.
Okay, that's Tana from Australia. From Sweden, A Man Called Ove.
Yeah, so this is a movie that, like, if we made it here, I'm going to describe it, and it doesn't sound that great. It's an old curmudgeon who's suicidal. His wife has died, the only thing he had to live for. And he finds a new lease on life by befriending and helping their neighbors who are very chaotic. So this guy is like comically curmudgeonly, and he has to control everything in his life. But of course, he starts to warm up as he makes these connections with his neighbors. And so the plot sounds a little trite, but it's done so beautifully Swedish, if that makes sense, that you just can't stop watching it. And the lead actor in this film is just such a presence. He's just a big, lumbering doofus of a guy, and you end up really loving him.
All right, sticking with Scandinavia, Denmark, Land of Mine.
This is actually a Danish, this is the Denmark's choice for the Oscars, but it's a Danish-German co-production. It's about a tough-as-nails Danish soldier after World War II who has to supervise a bunch of young German soldiers to remove mines from the beach. And of course, at the beginning of the movie, he hates these kids because they're Germans, and he's seen the carnage that the Germans have wrought. But he starts to realize as he works with them in this incredibly precarious, nerve-wracking work of removing these mines that they're children, basically, and that they, like he, were caught in this awful situation and that no one is ultimately responsible. So this is a movie where you see a tough character change over time, kind of like Ove, but it's done subtly and in the Scandinavian way, and it's a very tough and heartwarming film.
Okay, that's called Land of Mine. And finally, Tony Erdmann from Germany,
right,
also dealing with an older gentleman.
Right. So this is the story. It's a dark comedy, although we can argue about that. Certainly a cringeworthy movie about an uptight professional young woman and her father who's trying to gain her love by acting as this crazy character and their incredibly strained relationship. It was a very popular movie in Europe, but I think it's really, people are really divided about this film. Like, people pretty much either love it or hate it.
What did you think?
My feeling about it is that it has a kind of European sensibility that as Americans we may not be able to tap into, because certainly Europeans loved it and there are Americans that do as well.
And it's going to be remade with Jack Nicholson.
It is going to be remade with Jack Nicholson. And it might be, you know, this is one of those cases where the remake might actually be good, at least for Americans.
Okay. So is there any movie that you think should have made it in that didn't?
Well, Italy nominated a documentary called Fire at Sea. Which is an extraordinary film about, and deeply unpolemic film about, immigrants coming to the Italian island of Lampedusa. Mm-hmm. And it's basically two stories, the immigrants and then the people who live on the island. It's nominated for the documentary Oscar, which is fantastic. It would have been very interesting to see it in the foreign language category. I don't really know if a documentary...
Even though it's not a feature film, it's a documentary.
Yeah. Well, I don't... And no place does foreign language ever say that it has to be a feature. But either way, I'm glad that it's getting some exposure, because it is an extraordinary film, and it's one of those films that talks about immigration from a humanistic standpoint and not an ideological one.
Okay. So, final predictions. Who's going to win?
Well, the favorite was Tony Erdmann for a long time, and then came along Trump's travel ban. When Oscar Farhadi announced that he was not going to come to the United States, even after it seemed like it would be possible for him to do it, I think that is going to absolutely enamor him to Oscar voters, which isn't to take away from his film, because I think it's extraordinary, as most of his films are. So I do think The Salesman will end up winning.
So he'll win too, you think? That'll be his second.
That will be his second, yes.
All right, Matt Holzman, Thank you very much.
Go see these movies.
Go see these movies. Okay, this is how you can see them. Land of Mine, The Salesman, and Tony Erdmann are in theaters now, and you can rent A Man Called Ova and Tana on the streaming services. And, of course, the Oscars are this Sunday. Happy viewing.
Happy Oscars.
There, Julie Myers.
Hello, happy Friday.
Yeah, that's more like it.
That's right. So, of course, our listeners wanted to weigh in about
the Oscars.
That's right. So I asked our listeners on Facebook what Best Picture nominee they think will win versus what should win. And Anthony Williams says, I'm mentally preparing myself for La La Land beating Moonlight. I like La La Land. It's heartfelt and touching. But honestly, we've seen that type of film before. We've never had anything like Moonlight before. Nancy Foster said, you know, I just don't think that an award for Best Picture is actually a good thing at all because it undermines the ability of art to say all different kinds of things. When you boil it down to best or worst, you're kind of missing the point.
Simplistic, yeah.
She does say, though, that she enjoys The Parade of Dresses.
Who doesn't enjoy The Parade of
Dresses? I enjoy
it
so hard.
Yes, you and I love that.
Monday after. Exactly. Madeline and I are on the photo gallery for sure.
For sure. All right. Well, thank you. Have fun, whatever you do this weekend, watching, not watching, photo gallerying, what have you. Julie Myers, thank you so much. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.